Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
The Israeli military is now fighting Hamas militants on the ground in the Gaza Strip. Both sides have an obligation to follow international rules of war.
The warring parties must distinguish between civilians and combatants.
How the rules of war apply to this conflict. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, King Charles is in Kenya, expressing regret but no formal apology for atrocities under British colonial rule. And we speak with Caster Semenyo, one of the fastest runners ever, yet she is effectively banned from competition.
If testosterone play a role in my performance, why am I slower than men?
And our nod to the big day today.
Halloween is our busiest time of year, so it's our biggest month for sure.
But Halloween Down Under is not exactly the same as it is stateside. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining. We begin today in the Gaza Strip. After 24 straight days of Israeli airstrikes, the Palestinian death toll continues to rise. The Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza City was a scene of devastation this morning. Gaza's health ministry said that at least 50 people were killed and around 150 more injured. An entire residential block was reduced to rubble. Meanwhile, Israeli ground forces are reported to be attacking Hamas militants and infrastructure in northern Gaza. The Israeli military announced that two of its soldiers were killed today. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that Israel's objective is to destroy Hamas. He's ruled out the possibility of a ceasefire, citing the deaths of Israeli civilians in the Hamas attack of October 7th. All of this leads to questions about international law and the rules of war. Robert Goldman is a professor of law at American University and joins us from Washington. Robert, war is chaotic, often about surprise. So when we talk about the rules of war, where does that idea come from?
Well, it's actually been around for a long time. You can go back to virtually every major holy book of religion and you will find injunctions against doing certain things. The more modern law is found after in the wake of World War II and those horrors in the 1949 Geneva Conventions. Let me just say that the law seeks to do two things. One, to spare civilians and those no longer in the fight from the effects of hostilities, by placing prohibition and restraints on the conduct of warfare. So we have a good deal of law. One other thing to point out, I think, that most people don't realize, the modern law of war is not concerned with the causes of the armed conflict. That is, who's the aggressor, who's the victim. It just says that once armed conflict is underway, these are the rules.
So we'll get into specifics, but generally, is there enforcement of the rules of war?
Every country in the world today is bound by the 1949 Geneva Conventions, and they impose an obligation on the parties to train their armed forces, and that the armed forces should have a rigorous command and control over their troops such that they will prevent and punish violations of the law. If that does not occur, then you're left with the issue of war crimes and the exercise of jurisdiction over the perpetrators by either the International Criminal Court or an ad hoc court or by countries that are parties to the Geneva Convention.
Well, as you know and as you've seen, there are a lot of allegations flying around about this conflict. The UN says it's likely that war crimes might have been committed by both sides. From what you've seen, are there clear examples and what concerns you the most?
Well, let me just say something first, because before you start talking about war crimes, you have to know what the fundamental principle governing this and all conflicts is. And that is that at all times, the warring parties, that is the various sides, in this case, Hamas, their fighters and the Israeli armed forces, must distinguish between civilians and combatants and civilian objects and military objectives, and only attack the latter. Civilians enjoy protection against direct attack. Now, this requires three things to happen. One, the civilian and the civilian population should refrain from actively participating in the hostilities. Two, the party that controls the civilian population, in this case, Hamas in Gaza, cannot put their own citizens at heightened risk of harm by using them as human shields, or to locate, for instance, command and control below a hospital, in a mosque, store ammunition in UN sites, et cetera, et cetera. And the third thing, and the primary burden, is on the party that launches an attack. Gaza is the most densely populated piece of real estate on earth. And therefore, when you attack military objectives there, you are going to be required to do a pre-attack estimate that will weigh foreseeable or likely civilian casualties when weighed against the military advantage you get for the destruction of the target.
Robert Goldman, based on your description, do you see violations of rules of war on both sides?
On the Hamas one, it's been well established already. The world saw the result of this. Hamas is also, not only in this conflict, but in past conflicts, as well documented by groups that are not exactly friendly to Israel, such as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty, has consistently used its civilian population in order to shield Israeli military operations. In other words, they deliberately are placing their own population in harm's way. With Israel, it's going to be the overall campaign, and whether or not it is causing excessive casualties in the sense that if they're not intentional, have they been reckless? And as I said, you can't divorce it from the fact that bombing is going on throughout. Many people heeded Israel's, when they gave the notice for people to go to the south because military operations would take in the north. The problem is, where do people displace to? The borders are closed. There really are not safe areas. And on top of that is you have the aggravating circumstance of not creating humanitarian corridors that will permit unfettered access, subject obviously to checks that military weapons are not coming in that Hamas can use, that these are really having an enormously detrimental effect on the civilian population. And this will be for the International Criminal Court is going to be examining both the conduct of Hamas as well as Israel. And as I said, we're going to see what happens.
Well, you spoke about the high population density in Gaza, Robert, and I want to ask you specifically about hospitals because several have been targeted. Hospitals have special status. Explain how war is supposed to happen when there are hospitals in the theater.
Hospitals obviously have a form of special protection, but it can be lost. And it can be lost through their misuse and their use for military purposes. You shouldn't put command and control and combatants in a hospital. Wounded combatants is a different thing. They're out of the fight. They're entitled to respect. So the issue there is when you are shielding and using a hospital for military purposes, it doesn't mean that the Israelis can go ahead and attack it. Because if you have 10,000 civilians who have sought refuge in that hospital, even though the hospital may now technically, because of, let's say, command and control or weapons and so forth in there, loses immunity from attack, those civilians still enjoy protection from becoming excessive collateral damage. And again, one has to look at each and every one of these cases separately before one can arrive at a conclusion whether or not, one, it changed from being a protected civilian object to a military objective, and two, whether the party, in this case Israel, that is attacking has taken into due consideration what would foreseeably be collateral damage to civilians that would result from such an attack.
Robert Goldman is a professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law. He joined us from Washington. Robert, thank you very much indeed.
Delighted. Thank you.
The mass shooting in Lewiston, Maine last week that left 18 people dead sent shockwaves through a state that has long had a reputation for safety. That reputation is one factor that has drawn thousands of Somalis to Lewiston since the early 2000s. In fact, Maine's Somali community has been credited with reviving what had been a dying mill town. Now, some Somalis say the shooting has brought up traumatic memories from their own past and forced them to confront a kind of violence many of them had tried to escape. Maine Public Radio's Ari Snyder reports from Lewiston.
What do you think last week, shooting. Scary.
5 days after the shooting, Shukri Abashek is ringing up a customer at Mogadishu store in Lewiston. She's known to her customers as Mama Shukri, and has been a fixture of downtown Lewiston since she opened her store in 2007. She offers an array of East African food, spices, clothing, and other products. Today, though, business is slow.
Yeah, but not a lot of customers. It's not like before. It's very changed.
She says that's because even though the suspect in last week's mass shooting was found dead Friday night and the countywide lockdown lifted, many in the Somali community remain wary of venturing out.
They call me, they say, can I come outside? I say, yes, the guy died.
Like many Somalis in Lewiston, Abashek and her family fled the Somali Civil War in the 1990s. After being initially resettled in big cities such as Atlanta, many came to Lewiston looking for a smaller, safer place to live and raise families. Across the street, Abashek's daughter, Ifra Saeed Issa, runs a nonprofit focused on nonviolent communication and restorative justice. She says the shooting triggered fear and dark memories for community members who, like her, had already escaped war.
The violence, the unknown, what should we do? Are we safe?
Making matters worse, during the shooting and subsequent manhunt, Saeed Issa says community WhatsApp groups were flooded with unreliable information. At one point, she says there was a rumor that the shooter would target immigrant communities.
So it was those type of things that was being spread that even caused more fear amongst our community.
And she says that fear has persisted of possible copycat shootings. A few blocks away, Fausia Musa says the shooting came on a grim anniversary for her. Musa, who runs a nonprofit focused on empowering girls, was shot in Ethiopia last year while visiting family. She says the shooting in Lewiston unleashed a flood of terrible memories.
Including my historical trauma, because we flee from a war. And it took me years of therapy to get over the first childhood trauma.
Musa says many immigrant residents are already shouldering anxiety about friends and family members in their home countries.
People back home are not safe either, whether it's a drought or diseases or whatever, you know. There's some kind of sad news every day. So even though this was new to us in terms of Lewiston and what has happened and what has transpired, at the same time, it's not new.
A few days after the shooting, Musa says her primary concern is who will be there to support the victims after the dust settles.
Mukhtar, M-U-K-T-A-R.
Lewiston is slowly coming back to life. At his newly opened East African restaurant, Naima, Mukhtar Hirsi is serving a late lunch to a handful of customers. Hirsi is originally from the Somali region of Ethiopia. He fled multiple wars in East Africa before settling down in Maine with his wife in 2001.
When you are immigrant who grew up in a war-torn country, it brings a lot of memory, shooting, killing, all of that.
When he first learned of the shooting, Hirsi says he immediately got in touch with his two boys who attend Bates College, not far from his restaurant downtown, to make sure they were safe.
I was shocked, I was all over the place. Even though they were safe, but I was panicking, because this was new to us in Maine.
During the second day of the lockdown, as police searched for the suspect, Hirsi says he came into the restaurant to prepare and deliver food to families stuck at home with their children. Asked if the shooting has made him feel differently about living in Lewiston, Hirsi shakes his head.
No. We're Lewistonian, like they say. We're not going nowhere, no.
For The World, I'm Ari Snyder in Lewiston, Maine.
Olympic runner Caster Semenya became famous for lightning-fast times on the track, as well as for a public fight over whether she qualified to compete in women's events. She tells her story in a new memoir. Our conversation with Semenya is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Caster Semenya is one of the greatest 800-meter runners in track and field history.
Semenya running for gold now in front of Nian Saba and Bishop and Wambui, but she's left the others in her wake. And Caster Semenya is going to do what most people thought she would do in the 800, and she runs away and wins it brilliantly.
She's a two-time Olympic champion and a three-time world champion in the event, but that is not what she's known for. The South African has been effectively banned from the sport for having naturally high levels of testosterone. She's written about her journey and years of being publicly scrutinized in a new memoir called The Race to Be Myself, which is out today. She spoke with The World's Carolyn Beeler.
Caster, I want to start where this started for you, with your love of running, which you write both grounds you and sets you free. What did those early runs look like for you as a kid in South Africa?
I think my discovery about running started at the age of 6. And since then, it has been in my blood. It has been something that, you know, I'm passionate about, something that I love. And it makes me free, you know, running. So, yeah. I loved it.
So in your late teens, you were making a name for yourself on the international stage. And that's when you ran into what you called gender tests for the first time. These were extraordinarily invasive procedures, which you detail in your book. How difficult was it for you to revisit those memories, to write about them?
I would say it was a healing process, because you started realizing the pain you went through, you know. You start realizing that, you know, there were certain times where you were depressed. But I think what's fascinating about it is that me going back to those memories made me realize how lucky I am, because through that process, I had to discover myself. Mm-hmm. I had to find myself, you understand? I love myself the way I am. I am not going to let no human make me feel like I'm not enough. I think that's what makes this journey, you know, simple, and makes me thank all those haters, people who criticized me, who judged me, who made me feel like I don't belong. They made me, you know, stronger. They made me realize, you know what, there's more out of life than just focusing on, you know, negativity.
Mm. After these early gender tests, you write about finding out that you didn't have a uterus or fallopian tubes, and you have high levels of testosterone from a newspaper. Is that right? You learned about it the way everyone else did in the newspaper?
Oh, of course, you learn through that, because, you know, your results, they get leaked, you know, into a public space.
Yeah.
But what I like about it is that it's a learning curve to each and every individual to start understanding that in this world, we all different, we all born with our differences, you understand? And for me, for them doing that, I think they've helped me to educate people, to help other people so they can discover themselves. I think they've done me a good favor. They've done me a good deed, because of them, I am me, you understand?
We are today speaking with the distance of time, though. You had to process this very weighty news yourself while also dealing with the public reaction to it at the same time.
Yes.
I imagine, you know, that couldn't have been easy. What was that like?
For me, it was just all about learning human behavior. I always knew that people will always talk when you do good. When you do bad, they talk. At the end of the day, it's my choice how I'm going to take it out of them. You understand? Mm. And I didn't need to react through it. I needed to act through it. But me being quiet was the powerful tool that I've ever had, because I had power to own myself. Mm. I had power to own the story. You see, now when I'm mature enough, I can tell the story. Mm-hmm. I can tell it exactly how it happened. And that's a power as an individual you'll have in you.
I want to ask you more about that, your story. You've been under scrutiny from sports officials, the media, the general public for more than 14 years now.
Of course.
You rarely give interviews or make statements.
Yes.
Why are you choosing to speak now?
I feel ready. I felt more matured. Now I'm courageous enough to fight for what is right. I fear nothing. I only stand for what is right. I think it's all about just to fight for those young girls out there who cannot fight for themselves. Nothing else. And I want, you know, all those, you know, young girls out there who feel rejected, they must know that they must not fear rejection. They must accept themselves for who they are.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, I was born to do this. I'm going to continue doing it. I'm going to continue fighting for inclusivity and diverse. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Caster Semenya, an Olympic champion and professional runner from South Africa who's been banned from track and field due to her naturally high levels of testosterone. Caster, World Athletics, which is track and field's global governing body,
yes,
it bans women with high testosterone levels because they say it leads to an unfair advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you believe that this ban is unfair?
It's unfair because genetically, testosterone does not play any role in anyone's performance. I'll use myself as an example because if testosterone play a role in my performance, why am I slower than men if
mm-hmm.
they say I'm a man? Times I ran, they're not even close to that. Times that I ran, young girls are running now. I'm not even close to men's time. I just ran 154. Men are running 141.
Mm-hmm.
You get what I'm saying? It's a way huge gap. It don't make sense. So it's just the speculation where people, when they feel like women are doing great things, you're threatened. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
You took medication to lower your testosterone
yes.
levels for more than 5 years
of course.
That you would still be eligible to compete. That started in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a difficult decision for you to make?
Very, very difficult decision and a regret, if I may say, because when you're young, you make decisions based on desperations. You know, for me, the reason why I did it was just to get back into running because, like I said before, running makes me feel free. I feel free when I run. So I did it out of desperation. I didn't do it out of love. I didn't do it because I wanted to do it. It was not an easy journey. It was hard. Only now when I'm grown up, when I studied, you know, psychology, I started understanding that, you know what, I was in hell then.
You no longer compete as a runner, but do you still run?
I'm an athlete. I was born an athlete. As we speak, I run each and every day. I do my training each and every day because it's in me. It's something that I've been doing since I was, you know, a little girl. I'm a coach now. I develop kids, you know, young girls and boys, making sure that they get education, you know, that they get, you know, necessary, you know, equipments, you know, to get into sports. You know, it's not about me running anymore. I've accomplished everything in the world that I ever wanted. But now my mission is more on making sure that I build a human, I build, you know, an athlete, I build a leader. Yeah.
Caster Semenya is a 2-time Olympic champion from South Africa. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
No, thank you. I very appreciate it. Thank you for having me and sharing my story with you. God bless you.
Runner Caster Semenya, her memoir is out today. It's called The Race to Be Myself. She spoke with the world's Carolyn Beeler. More global stories still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. The Cockney accent. For generations, it's been the linguistic soundtrack of places like East London, but it's disappearing.
A lot of East Londoners have relocated to different parts of the southeast. People from the southeast and beyond have moved to London, and it's led to these sort of mixings of different dialects.
A distinctive English dialect morphs into something else. That's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. King Charles is in Kenya today, his first state visit to an African country since becoming monarch. The visit comes as Kenya celebrates 60 years of independence from British control. Charles tonight acknowledged the atrocities that Kenyans suffered during their fight for independence. But as The World's Orla Barry reports, for many Kenyans, that won't be enough.
King Charles and Queen Camilla got the full ceremonial treatment as they arrived at Nairobi State House this morning, the home of William Ruto, the Kenyan president. The red carpet was out and the Kenya Defence Forces band played the country's two national anthems before soldiers launched into a 21-gun salute. Buckingham Palace says the royal couple plan to take in, quote, the best of the country, from its young tech entrepreneurs and creatives to its beautiful forests and coastlines. On the streets of Nairobi, though, not everyone is that impressed. Some locals told Kenyan television that the visit would just add to the terrible traffic problems the capital already faces.
It will just cause a lot of congestion and confusion in the city, a lot of disruption of businesses.
For others, the king's visit will only be significant if he apologises for the abuse so many Kenyans suffered under almost 70 years of British rule, which began in 1895. Joel Kimutai Bosek is a lawyer in Nairobi. He tells me he represents thousands of Kenyans from the Kericho region. They were violently forced from their land by the British during colonial times, he says. And they want an unconditional apology for that.
All of them are saying that King Charles should publicly acknowledge that what happened from the time of Queen Victoria all the way to the time of Queen Elizabeth was wrong, was not right, and that he has to bite the bullet, apologize publicly, and make some kind of recommendation that there be compensation or reparation.
But political observers say a full-throated apology from the British king is not expected to happen. And there's a reason for that.
Charles can't apologise on behalf of the British government because he's not the British government, and he can't offer financial compensation for a similar reason.
Nick Cheeseman is a professor of democracy at the University of Birmingham. The most notorious example of the brutality of British forces in Kenya is known as the Mau Mau Uprising. In the 1950s, Mau Mau fighters in Kenya began a campaign to end British rule. But the rebellion was brutally suppressed. The Kenya Human Rights Commission estimates that 90,000 Kenyans were killed or injured during that uprising, and a further 160,000 were detained. British rule ended in 1963.
The garden party at Government House was an informal farewell to British rule in Kenya.
But it was a full 50 years later, in 2013, that the British government formally expressed regret for the atrocities committed by its forces and paid out around $24 million in a class action lawsuit. Lawyer Joel Kimutai Bosek says for many Kenyans he represents, it's really not about the money.
An apology will constitute, let's say, 70% of the healing, if you ask me. So we're not the kind of people who are looking for a huge monetary compensation. Far from it.
There are also calls for King Charles to address accusations of abuse allegedly carried out by UK soldiers in more recent years. There are still about 400 British troops in Kenya. A press conference to raise awareness about the allegations was stopped by Kenyan police in Nairobi yesterday. Democracy professor Nick Cheeseman isn't surprised by that. He says President Ruto is struggling right now with high inflation rates and a very high debt burden, and he really just wants Kenya and the king's visit to be seen in a positive light.
Anything that points Ruto as an international leader of respect, as somebody who can connect Kenya to influence and power and perhaps international financial assistance, is perhaps something that will be, you know, very welcome within State House in Kenya.
Today, the Kenyan president was at the king's side as he visited Uhuru Gardens, where Kenya declared independence in 1963.
Your Majesty, Your Excellency, sir, we are honoured to receive you on this historic day, on this historic ground.
The king unveiled a plaque to mark the occasion of his visit. Tonight in Nairobi, during a state banquet, King Charles said he felt the deepest regret for the atrocities Kenyans suffered during their struggle for independence. There were abhorrent and unjustifiable acts of violence committed against Kenyans, he said, and for that, there can be no excuse. But he stopped short of making a full apology. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
Mention the Cockney accent, and who comes to mind? Michael Caine, of course. The actor said in a 2009 interview that when he started his career in the 1950s, he decided against losing his strong Cockney accent.
I kept the accent in the hope that it would sort of break down a class barrier and say to young people like myself, you can do it. You don't have to be an actor. Anything you can do, it doesn't matter how you speak.
Our next guest has been researching the accents of East London and beyond for some years now and says that the Cockney accent is definitely in decline. Amanda Cole is a lecturer in the Department of Language and Linguistics at the University of Essex in the UK. She writes about her research at the Conversation website. So your research, Amanda, suggests that the Cockney accent is fading away. What is the evidence?
So it's some research I've done with some colleagues.
where we had sort of around 200 people from Southeast England, so young people, and we had recordings of them speaking, and we had a computer algorithm that we built that basically listened to the way that they spoke and grouped them based on similarities in their accent. And it determined that the people from Southeast England, including London, that there were these three sort of main accents. And among these accents, we didn't find that there was necessarily a Cockney accent. So it seems that there might be some young people that speak the accent, but it doesn't necessarily seem to be kind of one of the dominant accents. Instead, it's kind of more influenced some of the accents that we have now.
So how much of that has to do with the ways that populations from places where the Cockney accent was common have actually changed over the years?
Accents don't necessarily come into contact. People do, and people bring their accents with them. In particular, in my research, I've looked at this sort of 20th century movement of people out of East London into the surrounding counties, but particularly to Essex, which is the county that borders London. And actually what we find is that the way that people speak in this area is very, very similar to Cockney.
You were talking earlier, before this interview, that you actually speak with an estuary accent. What is estuary and what distinguishes it?
It's thought to be an accent that's spoken across the southeast of England. So I would say that I speak estuary English. So you can probably hear I don't speak exactly the same as Michael Caine. But actually, there's probably quite a lot of things that I say that maybe are quite similar. So it's kind of an accent that's spoken by more younger people. It's thought to have started in the 80s or 90s. And it's an accent that, again, is more associated with working class people, but has kind of evolved from Cockney. And the reason we call it estuary English is because it's thought to be most common along the Thames estuary. So the stretch of water where the River Thames flows out of London eastward and flows out into the North Sea, which is along the sort of county of Essex where a lot of East London has moved. So that's where it's thought that, estuary English is most strongly spoken, and that's why it's named that way.
Mm. So, Amanda, like Cockney, is estuary kind of class-based as well?
So across the whole of the UK, really, the way that people speak and the variation we find linguistically is very much based on class. Mm. What we tend to find is that the more working class someone is, the more they use kind of regional pronunciation. So the way they speak kind of marks them out more as where they come from. Whereas the higher classes, they tend to speak in a way that's more regionless, is perceived as more standard and neutral, although of course that's just perceptions, but doesn't mark them out so much as coming from a specific place. So estuary English has a lot of features that are perceived as incorrect. And again, this is complete social constructs. Of course, there's nothing inherently wrong or right about an accent, but a lot of that prejudice is linked to class prejudice because it's an accent spoken by working class people. So in my own research, I've looked at how people are sort of judged and evaluated on their accent. And it does very clearly map onto these sort of background characteristics of a person, particularly class. So I found that on average, a working class person in the southeast of England is judged about 14% less intelligent than an upper middle class person from the same region. So actually, based just on our accent saying the same thing, there can be these really big differences in how a person is judged. And that is very much to do with class and very much to do with a person's background.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because that's exactly what Michael Caine said earlier in that clip we had. Have you ever experienced like something that you weren't expecting as someone with an estuary accent?
I think it's something that obviously I've experienced a lot throughout my life of, having my accent kind of corrected in scare quotes or, just feeling maybe that you're not too seriously. And actually, I did put my own accent into the study that I said about where I asked people to make judgments. Right. And I did find confirmation of my thoughts that people did perceive me as unintelligent or did perceive me as sounding unfriendly.
What did it feel like for you when you had that confirmation?
I mean, it's not surprising in a way. As a linguist, we know that accent bias is a reality. We know that it's something that is real and that's happening and that does affect people's lives. So in a way, to have this research to back it up is actually really important because I think often accent can kind of go under the radar. And people maybe don't think it's an issue or they think that they're just kind of maintaining standards of English when they're correcting someone's language. So I think it's really important as linguists for us to be able to kind of evidence the real life implications of accent bias and to show that actually what's happening is we're discriminating against groups in society who have low status, who aren't the groups who need to be kind of held down by accent bias.
Amanda Cole's research about the Cockney accent and other accents is in The Conversation. She's a lecturer in the Department of Language and Linguistics at the University of Essex in the UK. Amanda, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
At the Vatican in Rome, a month-long meeting to discuss the future of the Catholic Church came to a close over the weekend. Church leaders from around the world discussed a range of issues, like the greater inclusion of LGBTQ members and the possibility of women's ordination. But as Rebecca Rossman reports, the divide between liberal and conservative Catholics leaves many of those in favor of reforms feeling like they're walking away empty-handed.
This hymn was part of the closing ceremony for the 2023 Synod held at the Vatican. Presided over by the Pope, a synod is a gathering of nearly 500 officials to discuss the Church's future. It usually happens once every 3 to 4 years. You could say this year's synod was different from all others. For the first time, lay people and women were included as voting members.
This is a big game changer.
That's Brad Hinsey, a professor of theology at Fordham University, who has been following the Catholic Church's evolution for about 40 years.
Why is this a game changer? It's because you flip the pyramid upside down. The people that were on the bottom can have a say. It's like, oh my gosh, this is great. I've been waiting to do this all my life.
For the first time, Hinsey says, people on the bottom of the pyramid were being listened to. But to many reformers, listening was all the church did.
In this document, for example, it's like, well, some people think this and some people think this and more research is needed. And you're like, oh, is that really all there is to it?
That's Susan Reynolds, an assistant professor of Catholic studies at Emory University in Atlanta. She gives the example of ordaining female deacons. Many reformers came into this year's synod hoping this hot-button issue would get an official backing by the institution. But while the final report said it was, quote, urgent for women to have a larger role in the church, it determined the question of women deacons required more research.
I think we've done the research. Women have done the research. Men have done the research. The research is clear. I think what it requires now is an act of courage.
Others say they have given up on waiting for that courage, like Kathleen Gibbons Shuck. She became a Roman Catholic priest 8 years ago after joining a Reform community church just outside of Philadelphia.
If the institutional church allowed women's ordination, I'm not sure I'd queue up, because the model, the system needs to be re-engineered. And I can't just move into the current model of priesthood that exists.
It's a model that doesn't welcome everybody to the table, Gibbons Shuck says. On that note, she says she was also disappointed by the report's conclusions, or lack thereof, about inclusion of LGBTQ people in the church. Despite initial chatter about the possibility of a recognition of same-sex unions, the phrase LGBTQ wasn't even mentioned in the final report. In its place, a vague statement which said those who feel marginalized from the church because of their sexuality, quote, asked to be listened to and accompanied, and that their dignity is defended. For Gibbons Shuck and others, that's not enough.
Most people, as we grow, have family members and friends who are gay, trans, and it's not the end of the world. This is the world we live in. And if the institution that exists to be spiritual community support can't recognize and engage with everyone equally, I think that's deeply sad.
Reverend James Martin is a Jesuit priest who works closely with the Catholic LGBT community in the United States.
Really what they want is to just feel at home in the Catholic Church, which is, after all, their church too.
Martin was appointed by Pope Francis himself to participate in this year's synod because of his work with the LGBTQ ministry. He acknowledges that discussions over the course of the synod were highly divergent.
There were people who talked about LGBTQ Catholics and shared their stories and wanted more inclusion and more of an outreach with the church. And then there were other people who felt that LGBTQ issues were really an ideology or kind of neo-colonialism foisted on other countries by the West.
In other words, Martin says for some people, the church is moving too fast. For others, it's not moving at all. But he remains hopeful and says, really, the conversation has only just begun. There will be more discussions when the Synod reconvenes for its second session next October. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman.
In recent days, we've reported on pricey charter flights operating between Haiti and Nicaragua. They've been a way for Haitians who want to migrate to the U.S. to get quickly to Central America, then start the journey north. Today, Haiti banned those flights without explanation. The move left a couple of thousand angry and bewildered travelers stranded in a parking lot near Haiti's main international airport. More than 260 of these flights have made the trip from Haiti to Nicaragua since August. They've carried an estimated 31,000 Haitians seeking to flee gang violence and a devastated economy. Experts say the seats on those charters were running between $3,000 and $5,000 each. Nicaragua was a popular destination because it offers visa-free entry for people from Haiti. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. South Korea is a long way from the Middle East, but the Israel-Hamas conflict is making Korean military officials nervous. South Korean troops are currently training alongside U.S. forces to repel potential Hamas-style surprise attacks from North Korea. According to the government in Seoul, the North Koreans have connections to Hamas. The World's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen is following the story. So, Patrick, Hamas and North Korea, what is the connection here? Why does the South Korean government think that live fire drills near the Korean border are necessary?
There are just enough similarities with the situation in Israel, Marco, to make South Korean generals sit up and pay attention. That border between North and South Korea, as we know, the most heavily defended in the world, high-tech cameras and sensors, drones flying overhead, seems impenetrable, but that's exactly what experts would say about the borderline between Israel and Gaza until it was breached by Hamas. So it's causing South Korea's military to ask, is our border more vulnerable than it seems? Could we be caught off guard just like the Israelis?
And what exactly are South Korean and U.S. troops doing to prepare for this kind of attack?
There are ongoing military exercises throughout this week. They've already had a major exercise with more than 5,000 U.S. and South Korean troops near the DMZ, the border between North and South Korea, practicing for, in their words, Hamas-style sudden attacks. So what that would mean in context is North Korea suddenly firing a wave of rockets into the South, and South Korea and the U.S. are specifically practicing using radar and surveillance to quickly pinpoint where the North Korean rockets would be coming from and blasting those precise coordinates as quickly as possible.
You mentioned just a second ago the DMZ, the land that divides the two Koreas, that's the demilitarized zone. And despite its name, it is heavily militarized. So when you speak with experts, how realistic do they think this sort of threat coming from North Korea is?
Yeah, I put that question to Dan Pinkston. He's a military expert based in Seoul with Troy University. And he actually does not think that the Hamas attacks would change the calculation for North Korea.
Generally, the weaker state does not attack a stronger one. Normally, it's a state that believes it can defeat the other actor.
He also said that, yes, the North Koreans being weaker would want the element of surprise, but that border, that DMZ, it really just is one of the most monitored zones on Earth.
It's just inconceivable for me to think that they would be able to achieve that without some foreknowledge of that. There would at least be a couple of days.
Yeah, a couple of days of warnings or leaks. I mean, it is striking how the Mideast conflict is resonating all the way over there on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea says that there are links between North Korea and Hamas. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's coming from South Korean intelligence. They strongly link North Korea and Hamas, insisting that North Korea sells rockets to Hamas, saying they have photo evidence that some of the artillery shells that have hit Israel this month were made in North Korea, and there's evidence to support that. They will also claim that North Korea shares tactics with Hamas, which is harder to prove. I should just say North Korea insists that that's all nonsense, and even the U.S. is more careful in associating Hamas and North Korea. On the other hand, there are very open and clear links between South Korea and Israel. South Korea is busy building its own version of Israel's Iron Dome, that defense system that intercepts Hamas rockets. So there are these hidden threads between Israel and the Korean Peninsula. And I think what we're seeing this week bears out that both Koreas do pay attention to the conflict, trying to learn lessons and adapt based on what's happening 5,000 miles away.
The World's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen is in Bangkok. Patrick, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
The candy and costumes that are synonymous with this day and night are not just a big deal here in the U.S. Halloween is quickly gaining popularity in Australia. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports from Sydney, where she went trick-or-treating while you and I were asleep.
My family got here a couple of months ago, and this is my kids' first Halloween in Australia. So before we went out trick-or-treating, I needed to set them straight, prepare them for inevitable disappointment, which is my parenting philosophy. Kids, I gotta warn you about something. Just keep your expectations lower, because it's not going to be the same as it is back in the U.S.
Okay.
Gabriel's 5. He's Darth Vader this year. And Lily, my 3-year-old, is
a beautiful princess.
Okay, we hit the streets, and as it turns out, I was dead wrong. We're in a neighborhood right outside of Sydney on the beach, and there are kids everywhere. Lots of houses on the block are decorated for Halloween with the cobwebs and the hairy spiders. But this one is the most impressive by far. There's a graveyard and a corpse clawing its way out of the ground. Skeletons scaling the front of the house. Claire is the owner.
So how did you guys start doing this? This is amazing.
This is our 4th year and it's just grown from here. And it's our neighborhood and everyone gets into it.
Did you do this as a kid?
Never. No. It's my husband. It's all my husband.
Trent says he's guilty as charged.
Yeah, it was all me.
Yeah.
I've spent some time in the States in the past, and I've seen Halloween over there, and I thought it'd be a good thing just to create that kind of tradition here with the young kids growing up, not to be too scared of scary things.
Australians are expected to spend $310 million on candy, costumes, and decorations this year. That's a 14% increase over last year, according to the Australian Retailers Association. Dean Salakis is the chief party dude, his term, not mine, at a huge party supply store in Sydney called The Party People. I had to stop in there earlier to stock up on lightsabers.
Halloween is our busiest time of year, so it's our biggest month for sure.
When do people start to come in to buy decorations, I'd say?
Some of the real fanatics come in early September, early August even. Really October is really kicks off, 1st of October.
Salakis says people are decorating earlier and earlier, taking their cues from American influencers on social media who do a whole spooky season. And walking around here tonight, it does feel a little like the U.S. But I notice that the holiday here is just more wholesome. No sexy witches, no sexy French maids, no sexy, just a whole lot of cuteness.
Can you describe your costume?
Skeleton.
No, I'm not a skeleton.
I'm a skeleton.
And a respectable amount of candy.
Hello, world. I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. See you again tomorrow. From PRX.